be ready to make an account for the hope that is in you. Please be seated. Way back, before I was a priest, in that narrow window of time, when I was the lowliest person in the New York City independent film business, I had a friend who had an idea for a movie. Now, this was New York, so everybody had an idea for a movie. But this friend, who was also a playwright, had written a script for it. And in sharing the story about it with me, he also mentioned that he already knew in his dream scenario who he would want to have star in his movie. And the actor he chose was a guy named Liev Schreiber. Who is a working actor. This has been 30 years, but you would probably recognize him if you saw him. Now, I will say about this friend's script and about his idea that he shared with me some of the other movies that were his favorite, and I could pretty much tell you from that his script was not one that I would want to make or, for that matter, even see it. It was fringe at best. I think that would be saying, being a little bit kind. But still, it was an idea, and he was a creative guy, and that was that. So before too long, I was working on a movie where this same actor, Liev Schreiber, was a leading player. Now, my role was not very glamorous. Fetch things, keep things quiet, and occasionally escort an actor to set from hair and makeup so they can show up and do their thing. Now, to set the stage, we were shooting in the Guggenheim Museum. So do you have an idea of what that looked like? Well, one day I was asked or told to escort Mr. Schreiber to set to where they were filming, just a few floors up. Now, there, as the elevators, the elevator doors closed on us. Now, here he's a bit taller than I am, and I'm here. I've got a little headset and a little clipboard, walkie-talkie, all that. And the elevator doors close, and suddenly I start thinking about my friend with a script, and if I should be a good friend and say something to this actor who is next to me. And I will say this was 30 years ago. I was like 22, so prefrontal cortex, not fully developed, so maybe an impulsive decision in that moment. I also thought, hey, here we are. Why else are we here in this city if not to make connections? And so I took a deep breath, and I turned to Mr. Schreiber, and in the 20 seconds that we were together, I said, my friend has this idea for a film, here's what it is, and here's what he envisions you being in it, what do you think? My only advice to you is, never do this. Never, ever do this. I was in no shape to make this pitch about an idea that I wasn't actually very excited about anyway. Actors are artists, and they don't need to be bothered in an elevator ride to set. But I will say, he stood there and he listened. And then as the elevator doors began to open, he turned to me and he said, in so many words, but more graciously, that is not a very good idea. And he walked out. He was right. It was not a very good idea. And I was admittedly in no way prepared with either a rehearsed pitch or even an embodied commitment to what I was doing, to what I was talking about. I was not excited about this idea, to say nothing about the fact that I really probably shouldn't have been asking in that moment anyway. But it was literally an elevator pitch. But in every way that counted, I was not ready for it. The author of Peter's first letter writes, always be ready to make your defense to anyone who demands from you an accounting for the hope that is in you. Be ready to make an account for the hope that is in you. Now, that is not an elevator pitch that we are supposed to have at the ready, but you know, it's related. There are moments in which we really are called upon to account for our faith. And there have been times throughout history, admittedly rare, when one's life or livelihood depended on the answer. We must be ready, though, even if we do not face persecution, because our account for the hope that is in us reflects our very commitment to it. The author of this letter was giving the advice he did because those earliest Christians faced the reality that they would likely suffer for their faith. Now, even then, persecution could take many forms, and public executions were probably a rare exception. Yes, they are the stories of legend, and we know about them. They probably didn't happen as often as we think. More likely, early believers faced alienation from family and community and civic leaders, and civic life. But those life and death moments, they did sometimes happen. And so they had a keen sense of what they risked by following Jesus and how they responded in that moment could be decisive. Maybe it would have something to do with what the outcome of the situation would be. Maybe their life depended on it, but I would argue that more importantly, what was decisive in that moment was the glimpse of God that they had an opportunity to share. Do we face the lions today? Not that often. Constantine taught us a lesson that we have generally kept. Co-mingling with empire tends to keep the persecutions at bay. Now, whether or not that accounts for our hope and our faith, that's a different question entirely. All the same, to follow Jesus means that we will meet resistance. And so we should be ready to speak up about that which holds our hearts. No, we're not likely to run into the kind of persecution of legend from the first centuries of the Christian movement. But still, we do find resistance. We do find places in our lives, in our community, in our culture, where we're not taken seriously. Where our encounter with mystery doesn't seem to have a language that plays in the public sphere. We live in an increasingly secular world, which has its benefits, to be sure. Yet when faith is marginalized, we lose a critical sense of what it means to be human. We lose our deep and embodied sense of belovedness. We stop seeing the face of Christ in one another. We lose our sense of the divine mystery that is all around us. To make an account is to reclaim the presence of the sacred in the world that God created. We must also be ready to make an account for the hope that leads us to seek peace and justice, to care for the poor, and to raise our voices against visions of faith that are based on power and prosperity rather than self-giving love. And this accounting is also a part of our inner lives, as the gremlins of ego and certainty and a diminished imagination conspire to distract us from the life-changing reality of hope. How do we do this? How do we account for the hope that is in us? How do we speak of our faith to a world that in so many ways has lost the sense of the loving image of God? The good news, this is good news for Episcopalians, the good news is that there is not actually an elevator pitch. If there was, we would have forums on it where we would come to class afterwards, we would write out and rehearse our elevator pitch, and I realized as I was preaching at the early service, guess what we have on this campus? We have real elevators. We could get in and practice our elevator pitch on one another, right? That would be good and awkward. Fortunately, that is not the reality. There is no script. There are no magic words. It's not a marketing exercise. I know none of us are terribly excited about being on the pitching side of that conversation, but how many of us would really want to be on the receiving end of that in the elevator too? Not many of us. Our answer, our accounting is in how we live. First, the letter says, do not fear what they fear. Now, that doesn't mean withdraw from the world or pretend that all matter is bad and that all spirit is good. Rather, live your life out of the hope that has sustained you rather than the fears by which the world would keep you in your place. Do not fear what they fear. They fear scarcity, alienation, suffering, death, embarrassment. And that, by the way, is everything you need to know about the ego. The ego fears death. Not the actual death, but rather the death of itself, the death of the false self, which lives to keep itself living and has a million ways to get each and every one of us to play along with it. Do not fear what they fear. Put healthy distance between what your spirit desires and what your ego fears. Rather than worrying about what we might lose, focus your energy on keeping a clear conscience, to go back to the letter, so that when you are maligned, those who abuse you for your good conduct in Christ may be put to shame. Now, I don't like talking about shame, so I think it helps to put this a little bit in context. This is a good tactical move when we think about speaking up against those who would persecute us or malign us for our faith or our integrity. My favorite professor, David Bartlett, wrote that shame doesn't mean making opponents feel bad, but by living ethically, by having a good conscience, they will lose standing and social power because they have been outflanked by kindness. Not passive aggression, actual kindness. Not self-righteousness, but genuine love. Because ultimately, we make our account not through what we say so much as how we say it. On this, the letter is clear. Be ready to account for your hope, yet do it with gentleness and reverence. Speak with gentleness and reverence. Why gentleness? Because Christ is gentle, and to imitate him is to follow him. To speak a word of kindness and gentleness in a world that is deeply unkind and knows so little of gentleness is to profess our faith. And because anyone, I think that anyone who puts you in harm's way because of your faith or because of your integrity or because of who you are has probably experienced great harm themselves and perhaps needs gentleness as much as anything. Do speak with gentleness and reverence. Why reverence? Because to speak of faith is to manifest our love for Jesus. Always be ready to account for the hope that is in you. That does not mean rehearsing the pitch that will change someone's heart in 30 seconds. Although, if you have a good one, I hope you'll share that with me. That's not likely to work. I can tell you with firsthand experience that that is a very uncomfortable elevator ride. But you know, sometimes the 30-second encounter is all we get. And sometimes what we say or what we do in that moment may be one of the most important encounters with God that that person gets to have. If we live our lives with an awareness of hope and a deep reverence for all that is sacred, then the authenticity and love that pours out from us over a lifetime or even in that brief encounter, that will make our account for us. Be ready to tell the story with your words, yes, but more importantly, with kindness, with reverence, with gentleness, with a keen awareness of the image of God in you and in every person you meet. Better yet, live a life that tells the story itself even before you've uttered a single word. Amen.